Case for argument is 16-2707, Vanda Pharmaceuticals v. Westward Pharmaceuticals.
May it please the court. Ken Schuler on behalf of Westward. I may also refer to Roxanne Laboratories. That was the entity that owned the ANDA at the time of the trial. As set forth in our supplemental letter brief, we believe this court has jurisdiction to reach the merits.
Can I just ask you about that? And thanks for the supplemental briefing from both of you. It was really helpful. But
I'm still a little confused. So they file an ANDA. They list several patents, or they list some patents.
The NDA.
Right, yeah. Not including the 610, obviously, because it hasn't been issued and you haven't put it in the Orange Book.
Correct.
I understand that it later gets put. What would have happened if they filed the ANDA with just the patents and you'd never gotten the 610 patent and everything else would have fallen out? Would there have been a lack of jurisdiction over their ANDA suit, or your suit against them under ANDA, or would it have been a failure?
I'm the ANDA applicant.
I know who you are.
Okay. Can you run that starting class again?
Well, you're the one that filed suit, right? Because the ANDA is the act of infringement. So you filed suit based on that ANDA.
No, we are,
you're the, sorry.
You're the ANDA applicant.
Correct.
Okay. So
we had been sued.
And you agree that there's jurisdiction. Sorry, I got you backwards.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But you still think that if they had never, I'm trying to figure out why the 610, putting that in the Orange Book and then putting it in the certification was good enough to let this case go forward.
Sure. The most straightforward way for, I think, me to address that is Rule 15D and the supplemental jurisdiction statute. And here's why. When we filed the certification, we had already been sued under the 198 patent. Everybody agrees that there's jurisdiction under E2 for that.
Okay.
The patent that's at issue had not issued as of the time that Roxanne filed its ANDA. So it can't be an E2 action. However, when we did our certification, that tied, in our minds, the certification, the ANDA at issue, to what was already pending, which is the 198 patent action, therefore making it a common set nucleus.
But if the 610 had never been filed and you had never added it and the 198 had dropped out,
it's expired.
It wouldn't have been a lack of jurisdiction. There would have just been no claim for infringement anymore.
If the 610 patent didn't exist?
Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay.
There would have been an action under the 198. That injunction would have expired because the patent expired.
Okay.
But you're saying the 610 is properly, in effect, part of a Hatch-Waxman action?
Well, it can be appended to the Hatch-Waxman action under 1367, under Rule 15. Right. And our view is that that would allow the exercise of jurisdiction under two different sets of circumstances. I'm happy to explain why that is the case, but I think we agree with Vanda, not on the mechanism to get there, but we agree that this panel has jurisdiction.
Now, you've challenged Claim 1 under Section 101.
Correct.
Why isn't this plainly and simply, not simply, but in effect, a method of treatment claim, a method of treating a patient with iloperidol, someone with schizophrenia, which is a predicate of it, consisting of administering the drug in a certain dose. Now, there are these portions of the claim, the if-then portions, but aren't those just predicates to justifying, to explaining to whom the drug should be administered, just like in the first two lines it says a method of treating a patient, where the patient is suffering from schizophrenia. That's a predicate. So why isn't this, in effect, a method of treatment claim? The Supreme Court has, in effect, blessed such a claim in Mayo. So what's the problem under 101?
Well, I don't think that the Supreme Court has blessed it under Mayo. I think that Mayo actually highlights a straightforward application of the precepts in Mayo, highlights that it's patent ineligible. Under the first step, well, first of all, let me highlight that if Vanda is correct that the claims only require dosing a normal metabolizer with a normal dose of the drug, that's quintessentially conventional activity, and the only justification that they provided to the district court and that the district court embraced for allowing the claims as eligible would disappear. And so...
I'm sorry, can you run that
back? Yeah. Their claim construction says you only have to dose a normal metabolizer at a normal dose, and that it's an alternative to dose...
But it's also, the alternative is that you cut the dose in half for non-normal metabolizers.
Correct.
Right?
And under this court's precedent,
if
it's...
a method of treatment. How are you going to treat people who are PMs or whatever?
Correct.
Right?
But if it's an optional claim element, in other words, if it's either or, as Vanda suggests, then for purposes of validity, that optional element, the dosing of the poor metabolizers, disappears from the claim for purposes of evaluating validity. And it's quintessentially conventional activity to give a normal dose to somebody who's got a normal metabolism. But our view is the claims are ineligible under our construction of the claims as well. In Mayo...
But what you're saying is method of treatment claims are not permissible under Mayo. Mayo says, unlike, say, a typical patent on a new drug or a new way of using an existing drug, they exempted methods of treatment, as a patent should have, under the prohibition in Mayo.
Well, I think that our view is that Mayo was a method of treatment. It talked about administering a thiopurine drug.
But it was basically a diagnostic claim.
It didn't have any methods of treatment. It just said, perform this analysis and adjust accordingly. If you had the same thing here, run the genetic test and then adjust accordingly, you might be correct that Mayo covers it, but it has more specificity of use different dosage levels.
It does, but I think that's a distinction without a difference. I mean, all of the dosage levels...
Is that exactly what the distinction Mayo made?
I don't think so. I think that Mayo said that all of the doses that a physician could adjust to are patent ineligible. In other words, because it's conventional activity for a physician to adjust a dose in with regard to potential side effects, that's conventional activity.
I don't understand how you can make that argument so broadly. We have dozens of cases where we've held dosing patents eligible or valid for various reasons, where the drug is known, side effects are known, and they come up with new methods of treatment or dosages to counteract those side effects. If your argument is correct, then any possible combination of or any method of dosing is just ineligible if the drug is known and it's conventional to known to adjust.
I think that the distinction is, for instance, the 198 patent, we did not contend was ineligible under 101, and it had methods of treating schizophrenia by giving iloperidone. Those are exactly what Your Honor's talking about, a new way of using a drug.
What you're getting to is, in effect, double patenting or obviousness, but those issues aren't before us.
Well, what I'm saying is I think that when a drug is known and it's known to adjust the dose, simply adding genotyping, which is under Myriad, clearly a natural law, the inherited genetic status of somebody, whether you're a poor metabolizer or a normal metabolizer, is an inherited genetic trait, and merely appending to that, based on that status and your potential propensity for side effects, you should give a lower dose within a certain range. You know, under Mayo said dosing to address side effects is conventional and was conventional in 1998 as of the priority date of those patents. It clearly was conventional in 2004 as of these.
But Mayo didn't have any specificity into what the treatment method of treatement was, right? I mean,
it was a method of treating a certain condition with a thyroid.
But it didn't go to the dosing. It didn't say, and you're going to treat them for providing, therefore this group is going to get this much and this group is going to get this much.
Agreed. And my point is simply it said either go upward with the dose or downward with the dose. It didn't say that any of those precise doses would be patent eligible. Well, let me turn to our primary argument, I think, which is non-infringement, which is the record below showed that the potential rate of infringement was so low as a matter of law that one cannot infer intent to induce infringement.
I'm a little confused. I understand your argument, but it seems like you've got a two-part argument, and in my brain it's easier to separate, because it seems like part of your argument is there's no direct here.
Correct.
So can't be indirect because
there's
no direct.
Don't need to reach inducement, correct.
And then there are other arguments that are made that kind of don't deal with the direct, but say there's no specific intent because of what the label says. Am I right that they're really two separate things you're arguing?
That's right, and they're independent bases for reversing.
Okay.
With regard to the lack of intent to induce, the trial record showed that even under Vanda's construction of the claim, that a normal metabolizer being dosed at a normal dose is sufficient to satisfy the claim, only a single patient in the 6 years that the language they accused of inducement was in the label was treated in such a fashion.
But that sounds like an ordinary infringement claim, inducement claim, when you have to show direct infringement. Here, you conceded it's under Hatch-Waxman because there was an amendment of the ANDA, and so you don't have to prove. I mean, the whole point of E2 under Hatch-Waxman is you don't have to show acts of infringement. It's the filing of the ANDA or the amended ANDA, which is the act of infringement.
Well, that's the act of infringement that gives the court jurisdiction. That's not the act of infringement they have to prove to get an injunction. And so this, and by the way, this is not an action.
The injunction is built into the act. You know?
But this is not an action under E2 because the patent didn't exist at the time that the ANDA was filed. So there can't be an act of infringement under E2 for the 610 patent. Congress was very clear that it's got to be a patent, a use claimed in a patent. They could have provided for jurisdiction for uses claimed in a patent application, but they didn't. It's limited to a patent. But let me get back to the inducement. We think this is just like Warner-Lambert. This has to be a traditional 271B claim, and that's what they asserted at trial. But the rate of infringement is one instance of one patient potentially being dosed in an infringing fashion in the 6 years that the brand label had the same language that they accuse us of inducing infringement.
I'm confused because when we're talking about jurisdiction, you agreed that your ANDA, I'm going to get the parties wrong again, I guess. Did you file the ANDA?
Yes.
Okay. Your ANDA was an act of infringement.
Under the 198 patent. Which has expired. That was a separate action.
So why do we have, if we don't have jurisdiction under ANDA over the 610, how do we have jurisdiction over the 610?
Because what...
I thought your argument was because it was then listed and you updated your certification that brought it into the ANDA.
What it does is it makes it a common set of operative fact under 1367.
So you're getting the 15D. I think they're arguing differently.
I think they are too.
So if we disagree with you that it brings it in under 15D, but that it becomes part of the ANDA, then your argument that there's no direct act of infringement falls away because we have ANDA.
You have jurisdiction. But that's the act of infringement for jurisdictional purposes is the filing of the ANDA. That doesn't mean that's an act of infringement. They still have to show infringement under some section 271 A, B, or C.
Not under ANDA.
Yes, I think they do. That's this court's
isn't
jurisprudence.
The filing of the ANDA the
jurisdiction.
Act of infringement. It is the, so when you file an ANDA, they don't have to show that they're selling the drug because they usually aren't selling the drug.
That's correct. What the analysis does is it said, hypothetically, would this label induce infringement if the drug were to be sold? But here we know that the same label has been on the market for 6 years, and nobody has practiced the claims. And so just like Warner-Lambert, the rate of potential infringement is so low that it's a matter of law.
First, Warner-Lambert was an off-label case, and one could argue that there's a distinction to be made here between on-label and off-label. And secondly, and so you can respond to both points at once, I assume you're familiar with our recent opinion in Sanofi. right, which dealt with an analogous issue.
Yes.
And they're right. I mean, Sanofi, part of what the majority relied on there was the 77% use, and they relied heavily on that. On the other hand, they go on to cite Eli Lilly as saying that depending on the clarity of the drug's label instructions, the decision to continue seeking FDA approval of those instructions may be sufficient evidence of specific intent to induce infringement. So they seem to rely more heavily on what the label says.
Right. And here, we believe that effectively that Warner-Lambert and Sanofi are goalposts, where the majority of the sales, as in Sanofi, are, you know, pursuant to the label, it makes economic sense that the generic company intends for physicians to practice according to that level of sales. But as in Warner-Lambert, where the purported sales are so low, it defies common sense, I think this court said, to say that somebody would intend to induce aberrant behavior. And I think that's the distinction we see, is that when we're far below the
two... But don't you think our cases like Eli Lilly sort of say, if you're talking about an on-label case and the label is clear enough and explicitly, you know, whether it recommends or instructs or whatever word we want to use,
it all comes down
that
to,
is sufficient.
It all comes down to the circumstances. Are the
Hypothetically, if I know you have quibbles about the clarity of this label, but if we read this label to instruct lower dosage based upon the genotype testing, isn't that enough for inducement?
No, because there's a separate element that says you have to recommend genotyping. That's a separate step. The district court cited
no... No, but my hypothetical said we read this label as requiring genotyping.
Oh, if you... I'm not sure, because my view is that under this court's case law, the question is whether it instructs the direct infringer. And so the salient inquiry is whether the physician regards it as a recommendation to do genotyping, not whether a judge reads it as such.
So you just say that's evidence to show that there was no intent of the physicians, if there's no evidence of physicians doing it. What you have here, though, are fact findings by the district court judge, and we've got to defer to those fact findings. That's not to say if he had read the label differently or the experts had been differently, but he relied on explicit expert testimony. He credited some experts over others.
If I may address that question, that's exactly the problem. The court did not cite any expert testimony, any physician testimony, on whether the label recommends genotyping. He cited only the label language that says laboratory tests to identify CYP2D6 PMs exist. Okay? In fact, all of the physicians tested.
I know I'm running you over your time, if you don't mind.
But that's okay.
Is there, and what kind of laboratory tests are there to identify CYP, however you say that, besides genotype testing?
I think there are only genotypic testing, but there's two salient questions. The first is whether it refers to genotyping. The second is.
You agree that the only way to identify this is through genotype testing, and the label says use laboratory tests to identify this.
It doesn't say use laboratory tests. It says they're available. And all of the expert physicians, Your Honor, all of them testify that it was not a recommendation. You also have Vanda's own Dr. Wyden, who wrote an article saying that there are no recommendations in the label to test variants for CYP2D6. Now, that language from a published article outside of the context of litigation, which parallels the infringement inquiry, alone shows clear error. Because the question isn't whether a judge views it as recommending. The question is whether the physicians view it as recommending. There was a wealth of other evidence. It's detailed in our briefs, and I'm happy to continue on. That evidence, so Dr. Retain testified that it wasn't a recommendation. That's at A7043. Dr. K also testified that the language at issue, that tests are available, is not a recommendation. That's at 7019. And Vanda's own expert, Dr. Presskorn, conceded that this...
Maybe we're talking about apples and oranges. What the district court relied on, I mean, we're parsing the language in the label, but the district court relied on the language should have their dose reduced by half.
That's for a separate step. The step of recommending genotyping, the district court solely relied on the language in the label and did not cite any testimony from any physician, and none existed.
How can you read those out of context? Because the prior step is dependent upon identifying that specific genotype. Dosage adjustments for patients taking this who are poor metabolizers of whatever that, however you're saying that, should be reduced by half.
And the only way to identify the people that have that are by doing genotype testing. So if the instruction is reduce it by half for these people, how else are you going to know to reduce it by half unless you do the genotype testing?
Well, the two answers to that are, first of all, it's informative. It's not a recommendation. There's another organization called the PharmaGKB that summarizes all the drug labels' information about genetics. They can concur that this label does not recommend genotyping. There are other labels that the FDA specifies when dosing CYP2D6 genotyping is recommended. For instance, the tetrabenazine label says patients should be genotyped.
So you're arguing the district court's decision on this was clear error?
Clear error because two reasons. First of all, it did not account for it. It did not look at the proper prism, which is would a physician view it as a recommendation, the direct infringer. Secondly, the evidence overwhelmingly says, and we're talking about information that literally parallels the infringement inquiry, there is evidence, a wealth of evidence saying that the statement at issue is not a recommendation of genotype. The PharmaGKB, Dr. Wyden's article, there was another blinded article that is at A698586. Vanda's own statement to the EMA, where they said that Fanapt has been used for years in the United States, quote, in the absence of genotyping. And we asked Dr. Presskorn, and he conceded. A fair reading of that admission is
did have one expert that said that laboratory tests available refers only to genotyping.
They had that. They never had anyone say that laboratory tests are available is a recommendation to genotype. Dr. Presskorn was their expert. He conceded that that is not a recommendation. He conceded that it was merely informative. He also conceded that it was a fair reading of Vanda's statement to the EMA that genotype, the label does not recommend genotyping.
But am I missing the context of this? I thought this drug was not allowed on the market or had to be taken off because for people with this genotype, it killed them.
No.
You're saying that the people with this genotype don't have susceptibility to cardiac arrest, and that's why it wasn't approved again until labels were put on?
I don't think it's limited to people with this genotype. There's just a general concern that the drug may prolong the QTC interval. But I don't think that it was taken off the market because of genotype.
Why wasn't it on the market? Why wasn't it on the market?
I think it wasn't. Its approval was delayed, I think, because of...
because people died when they took it.
Yeah.
I don't know if they...
They had cardiac arrest.
I don't know that, Your Honor. I think the testimony at trial
isn't
was...
Okay. I mean, if that's your view of the record.
Well, if the label instructs that you should give a lower dosage to people who have this, and the only way to do it is through the only way to discover whether or not you have this or not is genotyping, right? But are there other ways?
Yes,
that are available.
You can phenotype somebody. You can.
Are there laboratory tests? I mean, I know you can phenotype, but I mean, combine all of the labs.
Mayo would be a laboratory test to phenotype. So in Mayo, they looked at the metabolite in the blood, and that's phenotyping. Regardless of whether I have genotypically poor metabolizer status, if I have a certain metabolite level, that'll show that I'm metabolizing the drug at a certain level. It could be because I'm a smoker. It could be because I'm taking a concomitant drug that interferes with the ability to metabolize the drug. So you can phenotype somebody with looking at their drug levels phenotypically. That shows how you metabolize the drug physically as opposed to your genetic predisposition to doing so, which
is... So what is your argument that if the laboratory tests that nobody is saying that's a recommendation, so where does that take you in the inducement analysis?
That means that they have to prove every element, and they have to prove that the label recommends every element of the steps of the method, and they have no evidence of inducement, so that would be A. B, it...
They have no evidence because there's no genotype.
There's no recommendation to genotype. As, again, the corroborative evidence from outside of the litigation, which is their own advisory board member saying it doesn't recommend, the PharmaGKB, the fact that it's not reimbursed by Medicare, it's deemed investigatory, not necessary. All of that evidence shows clear. In addition, it corroborates the lack of intent, right? I mean, it corroborates that Roxane doesn't subjectively intend for people to engage in what's basically aberrant behavior. As Dr. Alva indicated. And remember, at the end, they're only evidence.
He indicated it was aberrant behavior to use genotyping.
To genotype and then put the dose within the level that's specified in the claims. Dr. Alva gave the same dose to the poor metabolizer that he genotyped as the normal metabolizer. And the claims, as Vanda concedes, require differential dosing based on genotype.
I thought at least there was one person that was identified by Dr. Alva where it was that he at some point, at least, and I know you argue it was a year and a half later, but that he prescribed, he was taking it at 12 and he upped his dosage to 16 because he wasn't identified through genotyping as being a whatever.
Right, and he
so
also...
the person that he used, that he prescribed based on genotyping, right?
Wasn't based on genotyping, and the point is he dosed the poor metabolizer and the normal metabolizer at the same rate. That's at A7000. And so...
For a while, right? Is that what you're saying?
No. The poor metabolizer always got 24 milligrams. That's at A7000. The normal metabolizer was at a lower rate and then was elevated based on his symptomology. He needed a higher dose. And that was, our view, is not an act of direct infringement. It wasn't predicated on the fact that he was a normal metabolizer. It was predicated on the need to dose or titrate to efficacy.
Was there any genotyping done on that patient?
Sorry?
Was genotyping done on that
patient? Yes. And, you know, it also bears emphasizing that...
Is there any evidence in the record of how... What percentage of the population has this?
I think the label says around 6%. It depends on your ethnicity.
Okay.
But, you know, in our view, there's a failure proof on direct infringement. They didn't prove that under the appropriate construction of the claims that, that a poor metabolizer has ever been given a dose of 12 milligrams a day or less. You know, the wear-in clause specifies that it's the poor metabolizer who we're concerned about because the wear-in clause says wherein the risk of QTC prolongation for the poor metabolizer is lower because they got a lower dose. And if no poor metabolizer has ever gotten that dose, then the wear-in clause can't work. And they haven't proven any instance of direct infringement. And as in Takeda, Takeda, you wouldn't need to reach the question of inducement. There's just insufficient evidence of direct infringement.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll start with infringement since that's perhaps fresh in our minds. So the district court did make fact findings, and the question for this court is whether those are clearly erroneous. The district court found that poor metabolizers in the label refers to genotypic poor metabolizers, in other words, people who have these genetic mutations. The district court found that the label is a recommendation to reduce the doses for those genotypic poor metabolizers.
You heard your friend. I mean, didn't he say that all the evidence that nobody testified that this was a recommendation? That the laboratory tests are available, is not a recommendation.
I think there's some fine wording here going on, Your Honor.
Okay.
Right? Roxanne, I'll call them Roxanne because that's what they were in the district court. Roxanne's expert conceded on the stand.
Can you name the expert?
Yes, Dr. Retain.
Okay.
Right? Two things. That the laboratory tests referred to are genotyping tests and that the label is a recommendation to reduce the dosage for people who have that genotype. Now, what the argument that I think I'm hearing is that even though the label recommends reducing the dosage for people with this genotype, it doesn't actually recommend using a genotyping test to identify those people. That because it uses the words is available. And what I think I'm hearing is an argument that has teased this apart to the point of destruction of all meaning. Right? The term in the label, laboratory tests are available to identify poor metabolizers, immediately follows language talking about poor metabolizers being those who are genotypically incapable of metabolizing this material. It clearly, in context, is telling the physician, if you want to identify the population for whom we are recommending a reduced dose, you can order a commercially available test. As the district court found and as the experts agreed, the only such test that exists commercially available is a genotyping test. And I think what we have here is a semantic argument that even though the label recommends reducing the dose for genetic poor metabolizers, and even though because it merely uses the words tests are available, that is not a, quote, recommendation, and therefore there is a failure of proof. We would submit that that is an argument that only a lawyer could love. And the question for this court is one of clear error. The district court reviewed this. It's a matter of fact.
So if genotyping tests or what everybody is using to do this, why is there so little proof, if any, that there's any direct infringement here? I know you say, well, this label was out there for 6 years.
I'm happy to address that, Your Honor. In our view, the entire issue of whether there be proof that people have used this out in the real world with the patent owner's product is not something that's legally required. And we didn't set out when we were putting our proofs together to address that. This is an ANDA case. The way we look at infringement is we look at what the label says and we say, what would happen? What does this label instruct people? I don't have to prove direct infringement.
In other words, does the label authorize that activity? If it's an ANDA case, then you don't need to prove infringement, right?
Exactly, Your Honor.
But is it an ANDA case? Is it a Hatch-Waxman case?
It is a Hatch-Waxman case, and let me
because
come to...
Because this wasn't patented at the time the ANDA was filed.
That's absolutely correct, but the ANDA was then amended. In fact, it was amended a number of times after the patent issued. And it was amended ultimately to include a paragraph 4 certification against this patent. And under the law of this court, that is absolutely an act of infringement under 271E2. And therefore, it just brings the case into the ANDA context and all the normal ANDA law applies. And this court has been unequivocal, and the strongest statement is in the Fearing case, Fearing versus Watson, at 764F3rd 1382. And specifically at 1390-91, where the court says repeatedly that our precedent, I'll just pick one statement, our own precedent conclusively establishes that sections 271E2 and 4 require consideration of the amended ANDA. And there are a number of similar statements like that. So following the law of this court, it is undoubted, that really in our view can be no doubt that there was an act of infringement under 271E2, certainly no later than the time during the pendency of the lawsuit when they amended to include a paragraph 4 certification.
But when we're looking at inducement, our cases have, most recently Sanofi, referred to the fact, because whether you say it's a lawyer's argument or whatever, there's been testimony and we're struggling here to conclude how clear the label is. So as in Sanofi, there was a clarity problem or a clarity issue, and they relied on the fact that in 77% of the cases this was being applied. So it's probative of inducement, is it not?
It could be under some circumstances, Your Honor. I wouldn't say that it's always probative. I would say there's a quartet of cases of this court, Sanofi being the last one, that lay out the law for circumstances like this. And those cases are AstraZeneca versus Apotex from 2010, Takeda from 2015, Eli Lilly versus Teva Parenteral from January of this year, and most recently Sanofi. And what they say is we look at the label language, and if the label instructs, recommends, promotes, or encourages the practice of the method, then that's an infringement under 271E2. Now, in Eli Lilly, there is a specific, from January of this year, there is a specific statement that we have not required, the court, has not required evidence of prevalence of the induced behavior, the infringement. And that is an absolutely accurate statement of the law. What happened here, we in fact called Dr. Alva primarily at trial for the reason of showing that people do genotype. Argument was made below, nobody genotypes. We called Dr. Alva, who testified that he had genotyped over about a 4-year period, some 300 patients. And since Dr. Alva was there, we said also, have you practiced the method? And he said, yes, I have. Right? We weren't doing that to try and prove prevalence.
Not for the 300 cases.
Not necessarily for the 300 cases, but we wanted to, since he was there, to at least show that he was following the method with at least some patients. But we didn't set out to prove, nor is there evidence below, I suggest, of overall prevalence of the method. What we have is the happenstance that one doctor who came along said he had practiced the method, and the district court so found.
Why isn't Claim 1 invalid under 101, according to Mayo?
Because I would agree, my view is that it's a method of treatment, that Mayo specifically says that methods of treatment are not within the ambit of what it's talking about. It is a method of treating schizophrenia, wherein you identify the population, the people to be treated, and divide them into two groups, and that it fails both steps of, in our view, it fails both steps of the Atlas test, right? That it is not directed to a law of nature, as this court found in Cells Direct. There is a big difference between a claim that...
In other words, you're saying the district court was wrong.
We are saying that. We believe that the district court was wrong, and that, in fact, this claim involves the application of three principles that could be characterized as laws of nature if you wanted to try to apply that. But there are three of them, not one. It's not directed to a law of nature. It involves the application.
That's because it has the dosing requirement. So you agree, if this patent ended where you just said that you identify who's got this PM and use a test to do that, that would be insufficient. That would be a Mayo case, right?
I actually don't agree with that, Your Honor, but because I think that what is going on is that we have not an issue that this court need resolve here, but we have a situation with this patent where it involves the intersection of three separate putative laws of nature, and that then leads us to a place where we could have a very elaborate debate as to whether that is or isn't a claim that's, quote, directed to a law of nature.
Well, one can take an action that utilizes a law of nature. Everything does, right?
I'm sorry?
Every action utilizes a law of nature.
100%, Your Honor. And in our view, the 101...
If you're treating pain with aspirin, aspirin interacts with whatever receptor it does through the law of nature.
That is exactly...
That's not ineligible. At least it wasn't.
That's exactly how we view this. And to come back to the Chief Judge's question, we think, though, that turning to the second step of Alice, that the dosing absolutely is a practical application of this that would confer patentability.
And why is that not routine? I mean, there's a debate on this as to whether or not it's routine. I know the district court said it wasn't routine, but there's not that much analysis there.
Because I think, Your Honor, that the right question is not whether dosing of any drug to any patient or patient population is routine. It's whether the dosing of this required by this claim is routine. Here, nobody had ever done this. Right. And in fact, to Judge Hughes' question...
Done what? Now, what are you referring to? You say nobody had ever done this. Nobody had ever cut the dosing in half? I mean, what this patent does is cut the dosing in half.
Nobody had ever reduced the QT risk, as far as we know, for any drug, but certainly for iloperidone, by cutting the dose in half. Right? And in order to understand why this invention would work, you have, first of all, to learn a very important fact, which is one of the things that the patent specification teaches the world, which is that there is a major difference when you look at the two metabolites, which are called P88 and P95. It turns out, and the inventors of this patent were the ones who found this, that P88 has the characteristic that causes QT prolongation, and P95 does not.
But you're dealing now with Alice Step 2, but
yes,
you wouldn't get to Alice Step 2. You think it's not claiming a law of nature?
Your Honor, we, Vanda, think that it's not a claim that is directed to a law of nature.
Because
it is a claim that involves the application of three separate laws of nature, and that as a legal matter, that is not the same as a claim that is directed to a law of nature.
Not because it's a specific treatment. We were talking before about this concludes this is a method of treatment.
That's not
your answer. So you think even the method of treatment puts it in a step two analysis?
I think that, Your Honor, that the step two analysis does involve the method of treatment, that it is about the specific dosage recommendations, which are determined based on the experimental work described in the patent, and that that is what causes it to pass step two. I also think, though the district court did not agree with us on this, that it passes step one as well, so that it would it would pass both steps.
In effect, it fails step one in that it's not a law of nature.
That's correct in our view, Your Honor.
But not because it's a method of treatment. Not because it includes the dosing requirements.
That's right, Your Honor. In our view, the inclusion of the dosing requirements is relevant to step two of the Alice test and does precisely pass that test.
And tell us again, briefly, I'm sorry to repeat, why it fails step one then in your view.
Why it is not routine.
Right.
Here's the reason, that when you give someone iloperidone, their body converts it into two different metabolites. One of them is called P88, one of them is called P95. Now, before the work that's described in this patent, nobody knew that P95 turns out to be approximately 10,000 times less potent in terms of causing the cardiac side effect, the QT prolongation. If you didn't know that, you would have no reason to adjust the dosing because it would be, some people have analogized it to moving deck chairs around on the Titanic. If both of the metabolites equally cause QT prolongation, the fact that somebody has more of one or less of the other doesn't matter, right? They've got the same amount of both of them in their body and they're going to have the same amount of QT prolongation. And what these inventors did, and this is precisely what's referred to in the patent and what the district court referred to when referencing intermediate biomarkers, was they looked at the ratio of the two metabolites and they correlated that to the genetic polymorphisms. And they, from that, they for the first time were able to understand that the effect of the polymorphisms was to expose you to a greater QT risk, and that you could mitigate that by reducing the dose for people who had these polymorphisms. That was not known anywhere, and therefore it is not routine in any sense of the word. And to Judge Hughes' question, by the way, the patent, Judge Hughes, says that about 15% of the population have polymorphisms like this. The label says that it varies on depending on what ethnic group you're from, but that it, for Caucasians, I think it's something like 8 to 11%. So it's a minority, but a non-trivial amount of the overall population. And what they and Judge Hughes, to your questions earlier, it was absolutely, as the district court found, that the thing that stood in the way of this drug being approved when it was owned by Novartis was they could not find a way to overcome this side effect. And FDA is very reluctant to approve things that have this side effect. And so it was not until the inventors were able to come up with this that they went back and got the approval. And as we pointed out in the brief, Novartis paid, they sold the product for an amount and bought it back for 400 times that amount, which we thought was extremely strong evidence, and the district court found it was strong evidence that this was anything but routine. And so that's the way the landscape looks to us on the 101 issue. It's a method of treatment. We could debate. We don't think this court needs to engage on the step one question. The simpler way forward is simply to say, it, as the district court found, it certainly passes step two. It wasn't routine. The dosing absolutely is a concrete application of this. These inventors, in the words that Judge Bryson used in the Myriad case and have been repeated a lot since, as the people who discovered this effect, they were in an excellent position to write method claims, and that's exactly what they did here. And so what we have then is a method of treatment that enabled this medication to come to market and serve a patient population that needs it, which couldn't be done before. And that is, we would say, it's excellent evidence of the fact that step two was anything but routine. And,
has this label changed at any time in relation to when the 610 certification was made?
It has not changed any. The certification was made, Your Honor, in May of 2015. It has not changed since then. The label has been the same, I believe, at all material times for purposes of this litigation.
Well, for 6 years, right? About 6 years?
It wasn't the same when it was initially approved. The language was somewhat different. And then the FDA asked that this language, a more specific form of language about reducing the dosage by half for poor metabolizers be added, and that was added. I think that precedes any involvement by Westwood or Roxanne. But that happened during the course of the period of time that Vanda was selling the drug. And if there are other questions, I would be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you. 3 minutes.
On the question of direct infringement, I think that counsel made an interesting point. He said one of the reasons that the claims are non-conventional is that they had solved the issue of reducing the risk of QT prolongation for these poor metabolizers. That's the where-in clause. That proves that for direct infringement, you have to reduce the dose to a poor metabolizer, and they haven't shown that anyone's ever done that. Now, their suggestion that they don't have to, I think, is misguided. As this court found in Lilly, the Supreme Court in Akamai said that, and Lilly is in the Hatch-Waxman context, of course, liability for induced infringement under Section 271B must be predicated on direct infringement.
And there but that obviously wasn't in the ANDA Hatch-Waxman context.
Akamai was not, but I'm saying Lilly said in the Hatch-Waxman context, citing Akamai, that for inducement there must be evidence of direct infringement. And here there was a failure of proof. Counsel effectively conceded. They didn't set out to prove that there was direct infringement, and that's a failure of proof. Just like in Takeda, the court doesn't have to even get to the issue of inducement. Now, on inducement, I don't think it is a matter of semantics. When the language has been in the label for 6 years, and physicians say they do not regard it as a recommendation, that's not semantic. That is action or inaction. And what I think is pertinent is the reason that people aren't doing it is it's not reimbursed, it's not a recommendation. They'd be violating the standard of care if the standard of care truly was that the drug should only be given after genotyping and the label recommends genotyping. They'd be violating the standard of care when they don't do that. And that's why Dr. Retain testified without rebuttal that people simply aren't genotyping. It's not a matter of semantics when their own advisory board member says the label contains no recommendations.
Didn't Mr. Groombridge tell us about Dr. Alva saying he had done this genotyping 300 times?
But only 4 times for patients with that he had treated with iloperidone. So he may make it a practice to genotype all of his patients. I don't know. But the point is, all of the physicians that testified, Dr. Kay, Dr. Retain, Dr. Presscorn, all of them said they had never seen the method practice. They had never seen anybody genotyped on iloperidone. Those citations are in our brief, and I'm happy to supplement that. But simply, it's not being practiced. And our concern is affirming here simply because of the subjective views of a judge as to what a label recommends when there's no evidence that physicians view it as a recommendation would be dangerous in the sense that you would have extension of the patent monopoly of the patent on the compound and the method of use, because you could always find a subpopulation that should be treated slightly differently and amend your label and then patent it. And that's not what Hatch-Waxman's for. Hatch-Waxman is to allow the entry of generic drugs as soon as the pioneering patents expire. Affirmance here, when there's no evidence of direct infringement that anyone's ever practiced the claims as written, we think there was a failure of proof.
Thank you. We thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding for this morning.
All rise.